what do you think about being at the con? Going to the con for your second year in a row.
I can't wait. I'm very ultra excited.
This is my third year, and I didn't really think that, you know, I was just, asked on a whim to go, and I didn't really think that I would ever be a regular attendee.
What did you think when you were first invited? Were you like, alright,
I didn't know anything about, I never even heard of Tom, because like, remember we were talking about that earlier, it was just like, where you were like saying that, you know, you run into all kinds of people that have never even heard of Comic-Con, and I was certainly one of them.
Right.
And, you know, when Nate, my buddy Nate, had asked me, you know, if I wanted to go, I was like, what is it? And he explained it to me and told me a little bit about it, and I was like, yeah, why not? You know, I think it would be, I was new to California, and I think, you know, when you're new to a new place, you always want to try the most unique possible things, and that certainly fit the description. And we went and had a great time.
Were you expecting like a bunch of mouth breathers and wizard robes?
Of course, you know. I mean,
that's what you got.
You know, there is, of course, there's that, but then there's also that's not at all what I expected the whole thing to be. I figured it was too big for that. Meaning, it's open to too wide of an audience for it to just be like some stuffy room with, you know, like the penultimate, like the typical Simpsons comic book guy. You know,
right,
what I mean,
right,
it just doesn't.
Yeah.
It seemed to be, you know, it's 120,000 people.
Right.
You know?
I wonder if there's anybody out there who is like, they sold out, man. Like Comic-Con used to be about books. Most people seem to be whole hog into Comic-Con. It's everywhere.
Yeah.
It's like a phenomenon, but which is a little weird. Even since last year, my first year, obviously I knew enough about it from reading to be like, it's Comic-Con. Like, I want to be there. I know the kind of stuff that goes on. It just feels like in the last year, though, it became a super phenomenon. It's in Entertainment Weekly. It's in like all these, it's on TV shows talking about what's going to be there. And I personally attribute that to my presence last year.
Well, when you go, you get this, you know, you have to register. By registering, you put in your name and your address and all that stuff. So you get a mailer, you know, like a comic book, Comic-Con, supplemental, I guess you could call it. And one of the ones I was reading one year that had a bunch of facts about Comic-Con, and they were basically, one of the things that they were saying is that, well, you know, like one of the things that in any given time there's over 27,000 people on the main exhibit hall floor, at any given time during the day. And when I would go into some of these breakout rooms, like when I went for the one for Sin City, I mean, there was easily 2,000 people in one room. Just for that one particular breakout, in addition to the 27,000 people downstairs, and yada yada. So they say that it grows every single year.
Yeah.
So when you're facing those kinds of numbers and that kind of, this big of a convention, you can't just lock yourself into thinking that there's going to be one kind of person. And the thing that I've always enjoyed the most about Comic-Con, the only reason why, is I really don't know anything about comics. But what I do enjoy is just the pure energy and excitement in a crowd of 127,000 people. You know, it's just, everyone's there and everyone's having a good time and everyone's really into what they do. And I don't care if you're a nerd or if you're like, you know, a cool guy on campus or whatever. I mean, everyone's there and they're all thrown together and they're all excited and I just get high off that energy.
And everybody like smiles at each other and people in crazy costumes will pose for you.
Yeah.
It's tons of fun.
Yeah. I remember the first Comic-Con I had run into this guy who had a completely authentic looking, I mean, like, straight off the movie set Borg costume from Star Trek. And I remember walking up to him because, like, I walked out of, like, a panel or something and I looked and it was, like, this crowd of people gathered around him. And, you know, I walked up to him and I was a little sensitive because I was like, I didn't want to think that I was making fun of him or anything like that, because I certainly wasn't. I was just like, I was so in awe of his costume, and he seemed to kind of shy back, like when I just kind of like just directly approached him, and I was like, wow, I got to tell you, man, this is amazing costume. I was like, did you make this yourself? And he was like, kind of like taken back, and he was like really, really quiet and like reserved. Like, I don't know. I'm probably projecting or assuming, but it just seems like he doesn't really, he's not a very sociable person. And he was just, you know, very quietly, he was just like, yeah, I made it yourself. And I was like, man, you did an amazing job. This is absolutely an incredible costume and great work and, you know, just blown away. And, you know, he didn't know how to, he was just like, thank you, thank you. He didn't know how to respond. And it's just like, and I just think that's what's so cool about it is because, you know, even in his small way, you know, maybe personality-wise or personally or whatever, he's really excited to be there, and he's showing it by this amazing, you know, he must have spent hundreds of hours working on that.
Yeah, yeah. So. It's just such a strange, like, it's strange that that would be the place where all this stuff gathers. I mean, a comic book convention turns into the biggest venue for the movie studios, for artists of all types, not just comic books, but animation. And I wonder what it was. I mean, I'm sure there's somewhere you could read the history of Comic-Con and see when this transformation happened. But because there are other Comic-Cons, New York Comic-Con, there's one in Baltimore, I believe, and for some reason the San Diego one is the one that, like...
They talk about that in that supplemental thing I was talking about earlier, was that they had said that it started off as just a single room with, you know, just some stacks of comics kind of
and
thing.
Like 300 people, I think, right?
Yeah.
The first one.
Yeah, 300 people. Now, like, you can measure that, like, when Comic-Con opens in the morning, 300 people walk through the door in the first 3 seconds.
Right.
You know, it's like, wow, you know?
Yeah.
So...
It was really weird last year, my first year. I had no clue what to expect. And I think, like, it was different from what I anticipated, but it was just, I couldn't have predicted how, like, it just, it's such a, it is like a candy store feeling when you walk in.
Yeah.
It's just, like, every corner of my vision was something colorful and tantalizing and the logo of something that I'm a fan of that I wanted to run over and check out.
I gotta say, it was really fun going with it, because when I went with Nate the first year, neither one of us knew much about comics, but what we really like is movies and horror movies and all that stuff like that, and it's all represented there, and you know, we really enjoyed the Sin City panel and the Rob Zombie panel, and seeing Ray Bradbury was amazing, but going with you last year was a really enriching experience for me, because you're basically shuttling me around and saying, oh, that's that guy, and that's got that. It's like people who are like the voices behind animated characters that you've never seen,
right,
you
right.
know? I mean, I've never seen, I'm just saying you in a general right, sense. Right. It's just like, and you're walking up and you recognize these guys because you're just so knowledgeable, and I really appreciated that, because I got a chance to meet and talk to people that, whose work I totally know, but I would have passed them right by had I been there by myself. So,
yeah, it's kind of nice that also a lot of the unsung, like, they're in a certain way, they're no less well-known or famous than, like, Tom Hanks and movie stars. They're just, what they do is so different. It's nice to see them get their due and get their own little spotlight at Comic-Con, like Billy West having his own booth.
Yeah.
And a lot of these cartoonists.
Billy West was a trip, too.
Yeah, he was an interesting guy.
Funny guy.
He was tiny. I didn't know he was that small.
Yeah.
But he's very outgoing. Like, I think it was the first thing he did last year, right? And his was one of the first booths that was open. And
how the hell do you know what Billy West looks like?
I don't know.
That's so impressive.
Although he was in Mark Hamill's comic book, The Movie, in a small part, I believe.
Yeah, what was that?
It was like a mockumentary that Mark Hamill made. Part of it, I think, was shot at Comic-Con. And it was kind of like in it wanted to be in that Spinal Tap kind of vein.
Yeah.
Of, like, a fake documentary about the comics industry. And it was funny, but you kind of had to be a comics geek to get a lot of the stuff.
Got it.
So what's big? Let's go down the list of, I put together a list of panels in which I am interested in. Talked about some of these, but let's, Alright, today, we will miss Pixar Animation Studios, that's okay.
Because that starts
Dimension Films, Rob Zombie's Halloween remake, and Frank Darabont's The Mist.
I will be there front and center.
I will be there for an hour, after which I will skedaddle off to business of webcomics.
Really, Josh?
Why? Yes.
Why are you interested in the business of webcomics?
Well, it just speaks to me. Yeah, so there's that, and I have my reasons for being interested in that. Kevin Smith, which I think we both want to check out.
Yeah.
See what he's got to say. See what the fat man in the jersey has to say. I'm curious about this thing that he did, Reaper. It's like, I don't know if it's for Showtime, I forgot what network it's for, but it's a cable pilot that he directed about this guy who...
makes love with donkeys.
Yes. He's exclusively creating donkey show-related entertainment. No. So I think they're actually going to even show the whole pilot at the panel.
Oh, sweet.
I've got the Eisner Awards written down here. They're from 8:30 to 11:30.
No way. You can do that? I'm gonna be at the hotel bar or something.
No, I think I'd rather. And that's our window from 7:45 at the end of Kevin Smith until 9:15, which we'll get to in a moment, where we can go to dinner and get settled in the hotel room or whatever it is that we need to do. The Eisner Awards are interesting to read about afterwards, but I really don't think I would want to go to them.
Well, award ceremonies in general. I mean, heck, even the Oscars.
Right. Yeah, it's a lot more interesting to, like, talk about it ahead of time and like, bet on it and then find out afterwards. I can imagine how tedious it would be to be there.
I'll go to the Eisners when you're up for one.
I've still got time, right? I think the entry deadline is... I hope they have Best Comic Drawn This Afternoon Award.
In a bumpy ride. In the car, yeah. Screaming down the 405 towards San Diego.
And then, of course, the evening ends with our favorite panel. Worst Cartoons Ever.
Worst Cartoons Ever, yes.
Hosted by animation historian Jerry Beck.
It was a very funny guy.
Yep.
These are not only cartoons. These are the worst cartoons. Right. A man who was trying to look for the worst cartoons actually found.
Yeah, this is a man. I mean, he is the most respected animation historian. He knows his cartoons. He knows when he shows us, I don't remember the name of them, but the one with El Señor Ropo, the heavily caricatured Mexican rope character, and of course Super President. He knows that these are the worst. And Pow Wow the Indian Boy. And the one cartoon where the kids, I hope there's another one of these, it's two kids talking for the cartoon, and they animated them holding books up to their mouths, so they don't have to animate the lip sync.
Nice.
And then, of course, there's all manner of stuff. I'm trying to figure out what this, again, I don't need to go to all these things. I don't really want to go to the 1:30 Image Comics show, so that would give us, from whenever we get there, until 2:30 for a panel. So that could be a couple hours right there, dude.
Yeah.
I don't really care if we do the whole floor since we have 2 days. I think we did do the floor a couple times in one day last year, didn't we?
Yeah, which is a feat.
Yeah. And we didn't. I felt bad that we didn't. We were a little impatient, so I didn't meet Penny Arcade. You didn't meet Maddox.
You know, I wish I went up to Maddox. Because here's what I would have done. This is my encounter with Maddox right here that I played out in my mind.
Got it all figured out.
You see, Maddox is the most arrogant, opinionated, vicious, mean man on the internet. And I love him. And,
you got me into him.
Oh, yeah, he's just... I don't even know how I got into him, to be honest with you. And, so he had, when he was at Comic-Con last year, you know, I was thinking about it and I was like, you know, people who like Maddox really just rave about Maddox and they just kind of, you know, fawn like fanboys.
Right.
And I was like, I don't want to be a fanboy. I don't want to go up to him and, because he was standing there with his cape on.
Right.
And his crown. The best page in the universe, like, right. Firmly written behind him.
Yes.
And I totally just loved it. And he had said, figured that the best thing to say to Maddox when you meet him, you're standing in a line behind everyone, just like, oh, I love you, I love your work, and, you know, yada, yada, yada. And then it comes to me, and I figured the only thing I could really say to him that he would really appreciate is, I want you to punch me in the chest as hard as you can.
I really think you would have taken him.
And that's it. I mean, I'm a fairly big guy. I can take it, so it's not really that big of a deal, but it's just like, I think you would really appreciate it.
Yeah.
So, this was a little off subject. I wanted to know what you thought about Ratatouille, because we didn't really talk about it.
Yeah, Ratatouille. I really loved it.
And
I have to say that, I think we talked about it a little bit last night when I first saw you, but I thought the story's a hard sell for me.
Yeah.
The Ratatouille.
I read
premise.
The review. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And so I had faith because it's Brad Bird, and I really hoped, anyway, that he could do no wrong. And I really think he can, because it's so, like, he took what I would call a kind of stupid cartoon idea, and he sold it. It was so good. It was so convincing. And he's such, like, he is an amazing filmmaker, animation or not.
Yeah.
He's so good with characters. He's so good with story, even when stupid things are happening. Even when a rat is controlling a guy by tugging on his hair, which doesn't make any sense in animation or anywhere else, he just made it so good. So, I like
him. Well, a couple of things I thought about was, one is, you know, what makes a Pixar movie great and better than every other animated movie, and that to me is, it's a lot to do with the fact that if you really look at it, Pixar movies are not always funny. As a matter of fact, they're often not funny.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because they're real dramas.
Right.
And when they are funny, they're hilarious.
They earn huge laughs.
Yeah.
Within the drama.
Yeah. And I think that's what a lot of producers miss.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, well, what's everybody think about Ratatouille or, you know, any other Pixar movie? They're like, oh, it was just so funny.
Right.
You know, so that must be what makes a great story. Well, that's
right,
not
right.
it at all.
But yeah, the reason people thought it was so funny is because they bought into the drama so well.
Yeah.
That the and I have strong feelings about that anyway. That humor, if humor comes out of character and story, it's so much more memorable, and it will, you know, whether or not people realize why they're laughing, you'll laugh deeper and harder, and you'll remember. You'll have such a more.
You're emotionally engaged in that.
Yeah.
You're there with them. And it wasn't just relying on topical humor,
right,
where everyone in the audience is going to have a different level of exposure to whatever that topic is.
Yeah.
So for some, it could be a really hearty laugh. Another could be like, oh, okay, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
You know, something
right,
so.
Right.
But another thing I really, really liked about the movie was the fact that, like, even on the most simple things, every frame is so catered to. And there's so much interesting. There's so many ways that they could have. And I don't know why this one particular scene always sticks out in my head. But there's this scene when he arrives in Paris, and he's gonna go to the restaurant.
Right,
And instead of just showing him, like, you know, run maybe across the street and then he enters the restaurant, it's this whole huge, like, montage of things that he goes through.
Right.
And it's not a montage is the wrong word, but it's like one continuously long scene, and so many interesting and beautiful, funny, and everything, things happen just in the walk to this restaurant, which is literally just across the street.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yep.
And it's not over the top, and it's not, it just feels like a real journey.
Right.
And I just thought that was brilliant. Because I literally remember sitting in the theater saying, oh, okay, so he's going, so he's just going to go. And then I was just treated to this buffet of just beautiful animation and just really funny things.
And I think that's kind of a metaphor for an entire Pixar movie, because you don't get just the bare bones of a story about a rat or about talking cars. You get, like, the most they can possibly get out of it, and more than you ever expected. Like, they find a heart in it, and then they, like, exploit it to the fullest.
Did you notice that in Cars, there's one scene where you can look into the sky, and there's jet contrails in the sky, and there are tire tracks.
Really? I didn't know
How awesome is that?
Wow.
Look, where everything is a car, that makes complete sense. And it's funny, and it's just interesting.
I can't wait until Pixar movies start coming out on Blu-ray. That'll be like the best possible, you know, way to appreciate high def.
For sure.
To look at a Pixar film.
For sure. So tell me about it.
About it?
Yeah.
Time to talk about it?
About it.
Well, you know, Brian, you and I go way back. In fact, sitting here in this car, riding with you to Comic-Con, reminds me of a trip we made to Ithaca years ago, where we... You're like, what? Where we... I had a notebook.
When you acted in my horrible senior
film. When I acted in your wonderful senior film. Be on the river, look for it, and never find it.
Josh, I got the perfect role for you. Don't say a thing.
Nice. But I remember on that trip, what makes me think of that is we were working on our own little stories about a character named Gabe. And do you remember we took like that car ride and we developed the character of Gabe? We talked about his families and his family and his parents. And like we came up with a lot of great stuff. And I even ended up using that when I did the Gabe comics on my own. Like I still dug into that even though I changed a few of his details.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know, that's just kind of like... I've been, obviously we live thousands of miles apart now, but when I work on things, I always still think, I've got to run this by Brian, I got to get Brian's reaction, unless he doesn't like it, in which case he's wrong.
Well, I got to tell you, going along with the same spirit of what you just said, I was just recently relating my whole career is actually owed to you. Which is a little bit of a grand thing to say, but it's just kind of interesting how the whole universe works. Because, really quick story, I had, I was taking a class at Dutchess when we were going to school together, and we were supposed to go on a field trip, and it was a field trip that I was really, really looking forward to, where we were going to walk across that bridge that in Poughkeepsie, New York.
Oh, yeah.
It's an old railroad bridge that was shut down because there was a fire on it many, 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 many years ago. And so this guy has been trying to turn it into a footbridge so you get a chance to walk across the Hudson River.
Oh, you can do that.
So I was really looking forward to it. Well, on the day that the field trip was supposed to happen, I arrived at class and no one was there because everyone was actually at their designated place where they were supposed to get the bus to go over to it. to the thing. So I was like, cool, you know, class is canceled. There's my last class of the day. So I was like walking to my car, I decided to, you know, I missed out on this field trip I was looking forward to, and I decided to walk through the communications building on my way out. I was like, let me see what Josh is up to, you know, see if he's doing something. And I ran into you, and you had said, and you were like, oh, dude, you know, it's good to see you. I miss you. I'm glad you're here because I'm working on my senior project, a video project, and none of my crew showed up, or few of my crew showed up, and I needed help. I need help to work on it, which is, I suppose I should mention it, a show about a guy writing a play about trousers.
Yeah.
And so you swept me into this, I was like, of course, you know, I don't have any class. My class was canceled. Let me help you out. So you swept me into the control room of this video studio that I'd never been in before. And I was looking around, and it was like Star Trek. You know, I've never experienced anything like that before. And I was like, wow, look at all this stuff, you know. And I didn't know how to use any of it or whatever. So you literally just took me and you were like, okay, just hit this button. It was like literally just like play and record on a deck, you know. Out of all these buttons, I got two of them to use. Just sitting there, I remember sitting in that control room watching you and your girlfriend at the time acting your parts and doing the thing in the studio and watching it on the monitor and everything and looking around at all these buttons and everything in this room by myself. And I came to the conclusion, I was like, wow, really kind of like this. And it was at that moment that I decided to change my major, and I ultimately became a film major.
Wow, I didn't know I knew that.
Yeah. And so this is that weird twist of fate between my bad pursue this film career that I had, you know, gotten for myself, and I did well in school and all that fun stuff, but I just didn't have any, and it was hard to get motivated, and, you know, it's a small town, and I had small town mentality, and the big town, the big wide world was a scary place, and I finally kind of worked up the guts to start, you know, pushing out, and then I had my accident, yeah. So that was like hitting the reset button, because I was like, how am I going to recover from this? It took so much of my courage to, you know, so much effort to work up enough courage to do it the first time. So afterwards, you were working on that play. And you had asked me to do the sound design, and I was, you know, really looking forward to it. There I was with my back brace on and my shoulder harness thing. With a DAT recorder and a microphone, and right. You and Chad, recording all this stuff. And then, I think concurrently or shortly thereafter, I mean, I was a captive audience. I mean, I had to be, sponge bathed, you know, like my chest and stuff like that, like, because I couldn't move. I was, like, immobile. So at best, I could sit up for a number of hours during the day, and it turned out to be the most creative time of my life because I did a lot of writing then, which is something I don't generally do. And you and I started People Who Bring You Things, PWBYT.com, which was just a tremendously fun time. Because we worked on it every, was it Thursday or Wednesday? We would update the website.
I don't remember. I think it's Thursday.
Yeah, every Thursday we would update the website. And we would do news articles and all that fun stuff. And it was the most creative, to this day, the most creative I've ever been and the most fun I had ever had working on a project with somebody. It was a lot of hard work,
right,
and all that other stuff. But that website that you and I did together and working on Gabe, which brings this whole story full circle,
right.
Working on Gabe together, is what started my career. I got my first job because of that website and nothing else. I mean, I graduated from college at the top of my class, got great marks, worked on a lot of projects, got a lot of experience. Nothing got me that job other than PWBYT.com.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and it was just, it was amazing.
And that kind of brings it all around to it, which is something I want to... I think you know the story of Chronicle, my new comic strip. I've even outlined it on my website a little bit.
Yeah.
In general terms.
Yeah.
But I wanted to, like, get a little more specific and kind of feed you the whole thing and just get it taped.
He's a big city writer who kind of goes to a small town.
So let me, I think I actually, if I can be extra cheesy, I printed out my personal notes, like the short version of my Chronicle notes. This is my own little blurb. It's like only a short paragraph describing the whole thing. Disgraced former editor-in-chief of the City Times, Charles Burke, is relocated to the small upstate town of Riverbend, where a small upstate newspaper, the Riverbend Chronicle, has lost its eccentric 106-year-old editor-in-chief, August Q. Finch.
He's 106.
A big city professional in a town that has one internet-enabled computer in the library next to the records. Charles will do his best to fit in at work and around town. So that's the pitch, like the short and ugly pitch. And then I have 9 major characters and bios and all that stuff. But as far as like the main story goes, my urge is always to be like, to immediately qualify it and say, but this and that. But I mean, like, when you hear that pitch, do you roll your eyes and do you say, like, oh, another story like that?
No, I mean, it's kind of a typical fish out of water kind of a thing. But usually the fish out of water is like, he doesn't fit in or whatever, and he's got to try to overcome this. But
yeah.
I immediately think with this guy, that was cool. So, see the helicopter hovering over his.
Oh, yeah.
But this one, I feel like it's he's a fish out of water, but it's like he's not trying to overcome it. He just doesn't get it.
Yeah, like, yeah.
You know, to him, it's like another job, and he's just gonna like fast lock his way through it and everything. So
right.
There could be a good setup for that.
Okay. Yeah. Good. All right. Because to me, yeah, there's things I want to avoid. Like, I want to avoid, like, the Doc Hollywood and even, like, Cars. It is not about small town hicks and how they teach a big city guy to love again or whatever. Like,
yeah.
Everybody's, like, nobody's a total villain or a jerk, and nobody's totally, like, a down home. Like, everyone's just people. Yeah. It just so happened, and I specifically didn't make it down south versus up north. Like, it's an unnamed state, but it's the dynamic I'm going for is, like, New York City versus upstate New York.
Yeah.
It's not north-south, but there's definitely a difference in, you know, and I'm not saying the city is full of arrogant pricks and the country is where everybody's great. Everybody's fine, yeah. But there's just different perspectives.
It's kind of like Joel and Northern Exposure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's really more about, it's not about him, like, it is about him being a fast-talking city guy, but he's got to try and run a paper with no resources, basically. And they've got, let me just tell you about my characters, and that'll help you maybe understand the dynamic a little more, too. Here's my list of characters. Charles Burke, editor, honcho, chief. Not exactly shallow, but far from down to earth. On the outside, he's a big city go-getter. Inside, he's insecure and a little bit lonely. And he's pretty savvy when it comes to journalism and media. Too bad that's meaningless in Riverbed. And by the way, like, well, all right, we'll talk about the, like, arc of the whole story. Because, I mean, what's different about this from other comics that I've done, specifically the one I did for a year called Vinaigrette and Sons, is that was like a gag comic. I made up a setting, and then I was like, okay, joke. And this has got, like, I've got an arc. Like, it starts somewhere, and it goes somewhere.
Yeah.
And, Ted Phelps is Charles' best mate in the city. And he'll stop by from time to time to, like, remind Charles of the life he left behind in the city. Kind of gives him a link to the city and an excuse to go back to the city.
Ted Phelps, I'm sorry, he's a friend? Or?
Yeah, he's a friend.
Yeah, okay.
At first, I thought he was a co-worker at the Times, but I thought it might be better if he does something else, like if he had some kind of entrepreneurial job.
Yeah, he should do something radically different.
Uh-huh.
Like, he's some sort of a playboy. Like,
yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
He's well,
I thought
off
of putting him, like, in publishing so they could be friends, but he's, like, the editor of a GQ kind of magazine, and he's kind of, like you said, a playboy.
Yeah.
And he likes, you know, he goes on adventure weekends and that kind of stuff. And so he could be totally, like, you know, the kind of doily culture of Riverbed. He would, like, bring Chuck away from it for, like, exciting things, or maybe even, like, dangerous, foolhardy things.
But, you know, and then maybe with him, too, he should also, he should also have a distaste for the town.
Yeah, maybe.
You know?
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, your character needs, you know, like, the main character needs to sometimes justify, you know, he has to,
right,
he
right,
almost
right.
needs to stick up for
yeah, yeah, okay.
the town.
So, like, in a cheaper story, the attitude Charles might have towards the little town is actually embodied in his friend. And so Charles, who really doesn't fully understand it himself, finds himself in the position of defending it.
Yes.
And part of my mythos for the story is that, you know, why wouldn't he just be fired? Something's going to happen in the early month of the strip where he's going to get fired from his great job at the city as editor-in-chief. And it's got to be really bad to get him fired. But my idea is that he's got family connections. So he can't really get fired. He just gets relocated to a dying newspaper. And part of the impetus for the whole Riverbed thing is my time in Millbrook with the Taconic Press.
Uh-huh.
And it's just a little bit, an element of it. It was like a small town thing where one family ran the newspaper.
I forgot about that,
the
yeah.
town, yeah. I kind of had to, too. Well, not enough, but. Then we've got Brenda Caldwell, the administrative assistant, copy editor, archivist, etc. of the Riverbed Chronicle. She's competent, attractive, and down to earth.
I love the fact that she's got, like, 10 jobs.
She makes it happen.
Yeah.
She's basically the editor-in-chief. She's not, you know, by name. The eccentric old guy who died was, like, the face of it, and he had, like, the crazy ideas, but she really made it happen. And she'll kind of, like, clash with him. And another thing that I want to avoid, I mean, it seems like everything I say, I have a cliche I want to avoid, but it is not inevitable for Charles and her to have a romance. I don't want it to feel like it's going to happen. It might happen. It might not happen. It's not the point. You know what I mean? It's not like...
That was the first thing I thought about.
Yeah. I don't want to introduce these characters and then just have it be a countdown until they get together. I'm not really interested in that. And in fact, I'm going to make it very... I'm going to be sure to involve other people who might just as easily be, you know, because it's just so funny how in, like, these kind of stories, people only do two things, make jokes and have romance. Like, they don't do, like, anything in their life. So I want to make sure to explore.
You might not want to just fight that the whole time. I mean, maybe they do have a romance, but it just doesn't work out.
Right.
They have, like, an understanding. You know?
Right.
Or then she becomes kind of like his counselor for all his other frolicking relationships afterwards, and it's not really working out, you know, because she's the only one that really understands him, which leaves it up to interpretation. Well, are they ever going to get back together again?
Right. Well, I don't want that. If they have a history and they have, like, I just don't want it to be, I don't want it to become like Cheers, like, when are they going to hook up, or, you know, like,
yeah.
Because that sounds so one note to me. Like, I'm not against that idea. Of course, I've thought about it. And that's one of the first things you think about, especially when you create, like, types like this. You're like, oh, is there going to be a romance and that kind of stuff? And the reason it's called Chronicle is, it refers to the Riverbed Chronicle, but it's also the chronicle of Charles' life. So, I mean, it's going to go beyond and above his work. It's going to be his experiences, moving, having his life change. That's the notion. All right, this is one of my favorite characters, Art Sprague. The in-house cartoonist draws Riverbed Junction, that's Junction, the paper's one and only comic strip. He believes all art should be family-friendly. Whether or not it's funny or relevant doesn't seem to matter. He's basically like the Garfield guy. Like, he writes this kind of innocuous, funny, cute strip, unfunny, but cute strip that, like, sometimes I could even, like, show a strip within a strip. Like, one week it'll just be, you know, one day it'll just be a Riverbed Junction strip with, like, these cute little animals doing things and making observations about, like, how much they hate going to work or whatever, like, and, like, he's just this guy, he's kind of an ex-hippie, and he's just kind of a really mellow, nice guy, but he doesn't really, he's not, like, out to satirize anything.
Alright,
so that's Art Sprague. I just kind of like him because he's kind of a lampoon of where most mainstream comic strips are right now.
Uh-huh.
I also think it's funny that this rinky-dink, like, one little building newspaper has an in-house cartoonist. They have hardly anything else, and they, like, don't have computers, but they have an in-house cartoonist. Gene Hendershot, the one and only staff reporter and journalist of Riverbed Chronicle. A middle-aged guy with a family, not interested in getting the scoop or blowing the lid off anything. He just wants to tell people what happened. I kind of see him like, and I kind of designed him with like a Jerry Clark kind of guy in mind. Very nice, very sincere, a little Flandersy. I mean, without the religious aspect, but he's just kind of a really, you know, not the kind of guy you picture as a hard-hitting journalist. So this is what's going to be kind of frustrating to Charles, coming from the city where, you know, their newspaper had, like, an agenda, and they had hard-hitting news, and they were all about getting... This is just going to kind of be, like, you know, play enjoyed by all. Would be the kind of stories that they'll be...
That's hilarious.
One of the early storylines is going to be Chuck insisting that they get computers, and then everybody dealing with that fallout of that and learning how to use computers and stuff. And then after that, he's going to have to hire a tech support person, and that's Tabitha James. She's an after-school volunteer. She's a high school student who knows more about computers than basically anybody in town, so she'll come in. And that kind of gives a younger person, you know, perspective to the mix.
Uh-huh.
And there's Constance Hatch, town busybody and malcontent. The 80-year-old fusspot takes offense at even the most innocuous items printed in the Chronicle. No one but Miss Hatch has been featured on the letter to the editor page for 35 years.
That's hilarious.
Jonas Milford.
She's got the greatest potential.
Yeah,
so far. I mean, well, other than, you know, leads, but it's like her reaction, her counterpoint to things and stuff like that are really going to help.
Right, it's going to, yeah, it'll be like this kind of blockade to him. It's going to be like, at first he's going to worry about it and feel like, you know, what do I do? And then eventually he'll realize that she's just going to always be this voice.
And
all I have to do is just kind of ignore it or, like, figure out how to deal with it. Next character on my list is Jonas Milford, the printer. They still do old-fashioned printing. And, in fact, my idea, I don't know how this is going to play, but my idea is that he's, like, dressed like, what's his name from Kane, like, the one of the guys from the little glasses and the visor and the vest, like a newspaper, an old-fashioned newspaper man.
Oh, got it, yeah.
He doesn't want anything to do with modern technology, no resist the computer upgrade, and kind of have that old world mentality. I mean, another kind of like theme under the surface of Chronicle is that newspapers are dying.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like with new media and the internet, 24-hour news, newspapers are having trouble staying alive. And so it's going to kind of be like, not only is it this last kick of this industry, but he's trying to like make it happen in such an old-fashioned environment.
Got it.
Then there's August Q. Finch, the deceased founder, editor, and publisher of the Chronicle. He exists now in legend and as a frightening bust in the office inherited by Charles Burke.
Does the bust speak to him?
Raise an interesting point. I have a whole little checklist here of story points, story notes, and one of them that ends with question mark is, does August Finch appear to Charles and give him advice now and then? And if so, is it good advice or bad? I didn't know if
that... I think he should. That would be fun.
That was my immediate thought when I thought about the bust, and I thought about, like, oh, well, his spirit could appear to him. But I was like, I'm trying really hard to make this feel like the real-life experiences of a cartoon, of a comic strip guy. And it's going to be funny. It's not, like, supposed to be serious, but I would like the opportunity for, like, you know, real drama, comedic drama.
Well, I mean, it's not going to come to life and become animated, but it's like, you know, he sees it and it's got like thought balloon or something like that said, you know.
Yeah, I was thinking it would only appear in his office. Yeah. It would be like the bust. Yeah, it would like come to life and speak, and it would never be like when anybody else is around. But even that starts to feel like a gimmick, and so I would only do it if it really helped the story or was fun, or I couldn't think of anything
else.
Well,
you know, because you got to figure like, okay, so here's a guy who's used to a much, much bigger, you know, swimming in a much bigger pond, right? So he's surrounded by these wacko people in his mind, you know, that kind of a thing. That really all he has is himself, and he can project that onto the bust.
Right, right, right.
You know, so that way the bust would talk to him, because it would be like...
You know, I actually had that thought, too. I had that thought that I would introduce the notion, the gimmick of the talking bust, and he'd get advice from him. But then someday, the way to turn it on its ear would be that he actually, like, gets help because of it. Like, and he actually finds out why that was happening. That it was psychological. That it was his own way of coping with this new...
Because he's all he's
that's
got.
That's interesting. Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of like Gusteau appearing to Remy in Ratatouille.
Yes.
And helping him through. So I'm just ripping off a really good movie I just saw.
Well, you know, and they ripped it off from someone else. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's just, it's a story convention that works.
Right. Well, let me read some of my story notes to you. Then I actually have a dozen story lines plotted out, and I'm not going to go through all those, at least not on record, because, you know, they're my stories. But... That's what I'm most excited about, is I know where to... I know, like, up to a year from now where I'm gonna... what I'm gonna be doing. Some of my story notes. Chuck is fired for something... possibly something related to a personal... something incendiary from a personal email, like being slapped on the front page of the paper. Since he's the editor-in-chief, I figure he can be involved in last-minute changes.
Yeah.
Something will get botched. Something really embarrassing will get printed, like, as a top headline one morning, and that's how he'll get... that's how he'll lose his job.
Okay.
And he can't be fired because of a distant family connection, hence the reassignment. Argues with his GPS on the way up to Riverbed. GPS becomes confused and desperate because the town is so remote. So that was the gimmick I thought of, like, on his journey up state. It's, like, so remote that he's just, like, you start to get these weird... kind of like, if you ever use a GPS device?
Yeah.
It's, like, you know, recalculating. And it's, like, constantly, like... and you just start to get desperate and, like, cold, shivering, afraid.
Checking traffic is another one that they always say.
Mm-hmm. Where are you taking me? So that's one idea.
Hilarious.
And then I have, should August Finch appear to Charles? Once in a while, show a strip from the comic within the comic, Riverbed Junction. This was my personal note about the Brenda and Chuck thing. It should always seem possible that Brenda and Chuck might fall for each other, but it should never feel inevitable or even likely. Along those lines, they shouldn't be so antagonistic with each other as to forecast a romance. You don't want to make it like Moonlighting, where they like hate each other so much that it's inevitable that they're going to get together. It's just much more important to develop a real co-worker friend relationship.
I feel like he has to have a love interest somewhere.
Eventually. Else. But not like within, you know, upon moving into a new town. I mean, it would take time to play out. Absolutely. And I was thinking, actually, of starting it like... Everyone's going to assume that anyway with Brenda, and then introducing some kind of a third person to make it more complicated. Like, maybe, eventually...
Maybe it would be, like, a woman that moves into town that has a similar big city sensibility.
Yeah.
You know, so they've got something in common straight away.
And it should be after a while where Brenda and him have become friends. They've become legitimate friends now. It's over the awkward stage, and it's kind of like they get each other. Yeah. And all of a sudden, here's this girl who he really gets immediately. Like, she's from his old life, so it would be a little bit, like, awkward. And then my only other story note before I get into actual storylines is remember to pepper the strip with stories outside of office life. You've heard the pitch.
I won't.
That's basically it, my friend. Here's the part where you shoot it down and say that it'll never work.
I think it will because, you know, as a storyline, I mean, I think that you're being sensible about it. It's like you're kind of giving him more than one dimension, whereas his friend can have one dimension and therefore, you know, help to kind of tug him along. Because that helps to form more dimensions for the main character, for Charles. Mm-hmm. Because his friend is single-minded in his old world purpose, whereas the townspeople are single-minded in their own purpose. Mm-hmm. And he's torn between the two worlds, and he's constantly got the two... thing. And then in addition to that, you know, if you want to include it, he's got the bus, which is really his own inner monologue.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then there's the possibility of a love interest or not a love interest, and you can mess around with that. Mm-hmm. I guess the question that I have straight away, which doesn't really work in your pitch, is the fact that I don't get the sense... Like, so he gets banished to this small town, more or less. Is he disillusioned that they're, you know, sending him on a big assignment, and he thinks, you know, like the Invader Zim thing, where he thinks he's really, like, on a mission, but they're just trying to get rid of him?
No, no.
And if he's not, is he excited to try to start up with the new town, or is he disappointed? You know, like, he's just...
Here's my take on his attitude, and it has to do with a little bit with his background. He's young. He's probably like 28.
Yeah.
And he may or may not deserve the hotshot position he has, and so he's lucky to have it, and that's what he's got, and that's what he knows.
Yeah. Is this no 28-year-old would ever be an editor-in-chief.
Well, that's true. So
therefore, it has to be because of family connections.
Right. And so it's not like he's trapped in Riverbend.
Yeah.
It's that... Okay, hot shot. The only way you can still be a big fish is if you go to this place. Otherwise, he's free to go, do whatever he wants. But all he really knows is being the head honcho of a paper, so he's kind of determined to make it work.
But it sounds like he doesn't even really know that. Is he good at what he does? Or did he just get the job because of his family connection?
No, I mean, in my notes have him being good, or at least savvy. And that's another thing that will be very interesting and I think funny in Riverbed, is here's a guy, he really knows how it's done. He knows how to get the story. He knows how to, like, sensationalize. But it doesn't matter in a little town where, like, you know, Lemon Bars Enjoyed by All is the top story. So it's kind of like that attitude of the big shot city newspaper guy. He is good at it. He's not in over his head. So I don't know, maybe he's too young for that to work. Maybe I need to make him a little older to sell that idea that he actually is good at it. But he also... doesn't have anything else. He's naive. He's got prowess and he's good at the job, but he's at the same time naive, where he would want to cling to anything. He would still want to cling to this riverbed job.
Because that's the tricky part. That's the tricky bridge for me. Because if he's young, especially if he's young, because if he gets banished, I just think he'd be like, well, the heck with this. I'm gonna just do something else. You know, I'm not gonna go to some rinky-dink redneck town. You know, like the motivation to me needs to be stronger.
Mm-hmm.
Just like why he's there. Because everything else can work, you know, like, you know, that kind of stuff almost kind of writes itself. Mm-hmm. But if the reader is always wondering, why is this guy even trying? He's running into all these problems because in order to make the story interesting, he has to
overcome
problems.
How about this? I totally appreciate what you're saying, and I hadn't actually thought that through, but now that I'm thinking about it, what if there was a possibility that he could prove himself and get back? You go, we have this paper in Riverbed, and I tell you the truth, we're going to pull the plug on this little pissant town. You go and make something out of that paper, and maybe we'll forget about this thing.
But how would they pull the plug on the town? I mean, it's like, if it's the town has its own newspaper.
No, well, that's true. But I'm thinking it's like, you know, there's like Gannett News Service, and they own a bunch of local papers, but they're also part of a publishing conglomerate. Like, they would, you know what I mean? Like, the big shots, the board that own his paper, not his paper, it's not the City Times making that decision about the Riverbed. It's that they happen to be owned by the same umbrella publishing company.
You see, I think we should stop trying to solve this problem. I think what we should do is, he has to move to the town, not because of the work, not because of some, you know, big shots or whatever, or he printed something wrong, but because he has to move to the town for some other reason. Like,
but I don't know that he would, because that's part of the whole thing, is that he doesn't fit in, really. So why would he...
Yeah, it's got to be family or something, like... Maybe his father's dying, or, you know.
I didn't want to get into family. At least not. I didn't want someone to be there anyway. Yeah. I kind of like the idea of this guy alone, like literally out of water, like out of his environment, coming into a strange place and just meeting a whole town full of people.
But can there be any other reason why he would have to be there?
Well, what if these big shots who don't like him pitch it to him as, you're going to go save this little paper, when really they're just trying to get rid of him? And he's thinking the whole time, well, I'm going to whip this place into shape and these... You know, and do what I can, but then it's back to the city with me, and they have no intention of taking him back. But he doesn't know that.
So they kind of give him an assignment to get rid of him, but he doesn't. So
yeah.
He's not aware of.
So it's the same idea of these guys who are like, "What's with this hotshot kid? Like, he's successful, but he's not playing their game or whatever." I don't know. I guess I was okay with it the way it was because I would just, it would be my job to make it convincing in the writing, like. Just like Ratatouille, if you said to me a rat wants to be a cook, and he gets this guy to, like, help him, and he doesn't speak English, so he pulls on the guy's hair, I'd be like, what? But the way it's written and the way it's done is like, oh.
But to me, the only reason why that whole story works is because everything about the premise is unbelievable. So therefore, that's the rules. The rules are, we're just going to make up everything, and because the story is compelling enough. Because it relies on things that we can all relate to, like love and emotion and feelings and food and all this other stuff like that. That's why the story works. Because it doesn't have to be a rat; it could be anything. It could be a fucking. It could be a giraffe.
Right.
You know. You've established that the story and everything about it is fake, but it's based on human.
Right.
You know, realities, like human needs.
And so you think with Chronicle, it has to be sold more as plausible?
The Chronicle doesn't work like that, because the Chronicle, first of all, it's not talking people, or talking animals,
right.
It's talking people, and it's firmly based in a reality that we can all understand, and it's a reality that we're all experts on. So therefore, if every other part of your story is going to be convincing and engaging and interesting.
So if I give him a wacky talking squirrel as a sidekick, earned a whole lot of... Okay.
It's just that every part of the... If you want the whole story to hold up.
Yeah. All right, that's interesting. That's think cuisine.